by taking, just by taking out one of the, well, like X1, like what, when, why did that change happen from a physical mass to a not necessarily black hole?
Well, LHC reduction formula involves a physical mass.
Yes. Okay.
Our expression over here involves the Lagrangian and the mass in Lagrangian.
Which is not necessarily.
Not necessarily the same. Without some assumption between about the relationship between those, we can't use these formulas simultaneously. We'll discuss that more. This is certainly a questionable assumption. And I'll have a little more to say about that later today, and a lot more to say about that tomorrow.
Okay, so it's when we introduce the propagator, say, okay, we're now kind of using LSC, and because of that, we're not sure if the mass in the expression is physical anymore.
Yes. So we need this to make progress. And we can make it work, but that will have some consequences we'll discuss tomorrow.
I didn't get exactly where, why should we be careful about the replacing M physical with M?
What we have is this. This is what the operator in the LHC reduction formula. What we know is that if we act with Klein-Gordon operator with the mass in the Lagrangian, then we get that delta. So we want to use that. We're going to use it. We can use it as long as this is true. And we're going to justify this assumption tomorrow, or discuss more when we can use that assumption.
I mean, so up to the LHC reduction formula, we know that that's true. And from the going to the interaction picture, we know that the interacting endpoint function becomes the numerator and there, and we know that our Lagrangian of interacting Lagrangian has physical mass inside it. So
No, we don't know that.
Oh, we don't know that.
We don't know that.
You just said it's 1/2 m squared, phi squared. We don't know what it is.
We don't a priori know the relationship between the mass in the Lagrangian and the physical mass. And so we're almost there. We've got one integral left. It's an integral we can do. Again, it just gives us a delta. And so we get minus I lambda times delta, which is exactly the delta we'd expect. It's a delta that says that total forward momentum is conserved. And so that's tells us the matrix element is minus I lambda. Relating matrix element, we just get rid of this or factor out this delta, which shows up in all processes. And we were working to leading order, so there are higher order corrections. OK, so we're almost ready. Write down the Feynman rules for the matrix element. Just generalizing our experience here. There are two things we need to consider. One is how to justify this. And I'm going to make a claim. I'm not going to fully justify it today. I'll present a rough argument, but we will discuss it more tomorrow, and I'll fill in some of the details of why this is the case. So, in order for this relationship to work, for the process, the result I'm going to give you for the Feynman rules to work, what we need to do is that when we are drawing Feynman diagrams, particularly next to leading order refinement diagrams, we need to amputate them. So if we have a diagram like the one we just considered that has directions on the external legs, could be any kind of corrections, complicated as you like, what we need to do is amputate them. What amputation means, we take a diagram like this one, and there are corrections on the external legs. If the, in other words, if the external legs has interactions with itself before it interacts with any other part of the diagram, we remove that. So this diagram can be amputated in two places. I can take away this part of the diagram and take away that part of the diagram. After I do it, I'm left with the diagram we had before. And these, so I'm calling this part a correction to an external line. And what the corrections to the external line represent are the difference between the free propagator and the propagator of the interacting theory. Propagator of the interacting theory is represented in terms of Feynman diagrams. It's just the free propagator plus corrections. There'll be infinitely many corrections. One of the first few terms. And so we know something about the free propagator. We know what it looks like explicitly. What we're going to see tomorrow is that we can actually make some exact statements about the propagator of the interacting theory. And what these diagrams do is they basically represent a shift. They represent the shift in the mass from the Lagrangian to the physical mass. And so by throwing out these diagrams, is the same as using the physical mass here instead of the bare mass or the mass in the Lagrangian.
And is there any way you could like walk us through algebraically how to see that?
I will tomorrow.
Okay.
I will tomorrow, yes. Okay. So more on this tomorrow. The result is called the Chalin-Lemon spectral representation. And this result says that basically the throwing away these diagrams is the same as using the Klein-Gordon operator with the physical mass instead of the bare mass.
Sorry, I've got another question, but maybe you can tell me this is for tomorrow too. So we've got kind of this like infinite sum, right? Is this infinite sum the sum we were making that was like asymptotic, that asymptotically converges, or is this not the one that asymptotically converges?
Yes, so in general, our Feynman diagram sums are asymptotic.
So then, actually, this is not a well-formed question. Never mind. I was just going to ask kind of about the asymptotic nature and how you would eventually, like, you'd think more terms would get you closer to the physical mass, but I guess it's just in the nature of an asymptotic series that that's not how it works.
Right. So the method we're going to use to show this is not going to be perturbative. We're not going to use Feynman diagrams.
Whoa.
So this will be a rare exact result in quantum field theory.
That's amazing.
Okay, so I'm kind of confused. So the statement that you just made is that the claim that you just made is that if we remove all the terms that have extra powers of phi, from the second exponent of the exponential of the interaction Lagrangian. So instead of that, if you say instead of the m, we have the m physical, we are taking those into account?
Yes.
So there is no perturbation or mathematical, there is nothing approximate, there's no approximations going on. It's just the exact result. Because you say that you're amputating your diagrams and you're correcting the external lines. So so in that correction, all the results remain accurate?
Yes. So for 2-to-2 scattering, we can think about our diagrams as having two parts. There's the interactions of the particles with themselves before they interact with anything else. And that part we can deal with exactly. But there's also what's going on in the interior of the diagram. There's infinitely many, and we don't have an exact result for what's going on when the interaction diagrams.
Virtual particles?
Yes. So we can deal with part of it exactly, but not all of it.
Okay, so by removing the virtual particles in the amputation process, you're not... There is no approximation. You're just getting the exact result.
Right. We're using this result together with the LSE reduction.
Interesting.
More on that tomorrow.
Stay tuned.
Okay, there's one last thing we can do before we write down the Feynman rules, which is to consider the momentum conservation that occurs in these diagrams. So in our example, we were able to do our x integrals, and those just gave us deltas. We could do the more x integrals, and those gave us additional deltas. The x integrals that show up in our Feynman diagrams are our expressions for the scattering amplitude or matrix elements are very simple, and we can always do them explicitly and exactly. Let's consider what happens in general. We know that we expect an overall momentum conserving delta. In intermediate steps, we're also going to have additional momentum integrals from the Feynman propagator. Each Feynman propagator comes with an integral d4p. And we also, all of the x dependence comes from the x dependence of these Feynman propagators. These will also come with an exponential of I p dot x minus y. We also have lots of x integrals. So we'll have x integrals from LSZ, and we'll also from the vertices. So let's do a count. Because every x integral we do, we'll get a delta in momentum, and then we can use our momentum integrals to do some of those. We use the delta function to do some of the momentum integrals. So let's count what's left over in the end. And for our example, let's just do accounting for an example, and our result will work more generally, although the precise counting will be slightly different. Let's look at 2-to-2 scattering, as we've been doing in 5-4 theory. And let's consider a diagram with V vertices. And E edges. These are what, before I've called these lines. In a moment, we're going to consider loops, which also start with L. So I'm going to call these edges. So save the L for something else. OK, so the diagram we considered before, this one, had 4 edges, 1 direction vertex. We're considering something more general here. And let's count how many momentum integrals are left. After we do as many as we can, or as many as we can, except for, as many as we can. Or IM. So we're not going to do as many as we can necessarily in FSI, but in as many momentum integrals as we can in IM. In general, we'll have lots to start with and also lots of deltas. Okay, so the momentum integrals we'll start with. We'll start with 1 for each of our propagators. So that's just E. Then we lose some from the vertices. The vertices combined with these exponentials will give us deltas. Momentum. And so the number we're going to lose will be equal to the number of vertices minus internal vertices. We also have 4 from the LSE reduction formula.
So V is just internal vertices?
Internal vertices. This is LSE. And we're picking one out. We're leaving one out, so we don't. I did it like this. This is the delta that goes in the relationship between FSI and IM.
Minus 4 was outside.
This should be plus. So what we are left with is E minus V minus 3. OK, and Euler has a formula. It says that define the Euler characteristic of a graph like this is equal to V minus E minus L. And this will be fixed, at least if we fix the number of external points.
Hey, sorry, can you say what X is again?
This is called the Euler characteristic. And a key property for us is that it's a constant. Euler proved this, the mathematical result from graph theory.
What is L?
L here is the number of loops, 3+. So a diagram like this has one loop. A diagram like this will have two independent loops. I could write there's a loop here and a loop here. They're independent. I can't write one loop as a linear combination of other loops.
Is this, if it's like an Euler characteristic, so is this applied to like general graph theory and not, okay.
Yes.
Euler wasn't around for QFT.
Yeah, this is a purely math result. And here we're just looking at the topological properties of these graphs.
Could you go over what you mean by vertices and edges in the Euler characteristics for me?
Yes, so this graph here has two vertices. Says V equals two vertices. Edges are lines. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. This is E equals 6. And this diagram here has V equals 3 and E equals 8. And if I compute the Euler characteristic for these graphs, I should get the same thing. So this should have I equals V2 minus 6 minus 4 plus 1 is minus 3. And the same here.
So is it fixed if you have a set number of like external?
Yes.
I have a weird question. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the thing that I recalled about the Euler characteristic was that they're constant for a manifold. Or it's just a constant for any topological spaces, not just manifolds.
Yes, there's a version of this that for graphs. It works for any topological space.
Okay.
And so let's use that result. So the number of loops here is equal, just rearranging this equation. Is equal to, so chi is minus 3 for the graphs we're considering. So the number of loops is equal to V E minus V minus 3. And that's equal to the number of momentum intervals. And while this intermediate step depends on the theory and which number of external points, this is a general result that, in general, L is equal to the number of momentum intervals. So after we do as many momentum integrals we can using delta function, there's going to be some left over.
Can you explain it one more time? I didn't really understand why the momentum integrals are equal to the problems.
Well, Euler's formula tells us that this is equal to, L is equal to this. Over here, we counted the number of momentum integrals, and we found E minus V minus 3, which is E minus V minus chi, plus chi, should be plus chi. Because this is minus 3.
Why the number of momentum integrals is equal to that?
Well, we start with E from the Feynman propagators. We lose one from the X and also from the LC. Yes.
Specific value of chi in minus 3 depends on the 2-2 scattering that we're considering and also the Lagrangian, like if we had a different Lagrangian or a different number of like initial and final states.
Yeah, in particular, it depends on the number of initial and final states.
how Euler characteristic physically physically connect to number of like, it's something completely abstract, completely mathematical. How does it really connect? You wrote something and we just saw that the numbers are the same. It's like,
yes, so physically the argument here, and again, it's a bit loose because it's dangerous to put too much physical interpretation in the Feynman diagrams. But the story we want to tell, which gives us the right answer, is that this represents one or class of possible histories of the scattering process. And so if we start with particles with momentum, so if we think in the path integral formulation, anything that can happen in between should be allowed to happen. And in particular, there are diagrams that conserve momentum at these vertices and conserve momentum overall, for which the momentum of the internal particles is anything you like. So the integral corresponds to roughly to considering all possible paths.
To clarify, number of loops equal to E minus V plus chi is holds in general, right?
Yeah, this holds in general.
And it is also equal to the moment, number of moments.
Yes, this both of these hold. For the part that doesn't hold is that chi is minus 3 right, in general. That's not. Okay.
I just want to make sure I get it completely. So the Euler characteristic for the topological space of having two initial particles and two final particles for Klein-Gödel theory with this interaction, with the interaction Lagrangian,
yes,
that would be minus 3, right?
That's right. Okay, so we're ready to write down our Feynman rules. What we have is that IM is equal to the sum of completely connected amputated diagrams with an initial and M final particles. And I wrote completely connected because in practice, that's usually what we're interested in. They don't interfere. The diagrams with two or more connected components don't interfere with these ones. So in practice, this is almost always what we're interested in computing. These are the diagrams we can consider, and this is different from what the diagrams that contribute to the correlation function. So this amputation came from combining the LSC reduction formula, which we've discussed in detail, and the Chamberlain-Lehmann representation we'll discuss tomorrow. This comes from, these are the interesting ones, and they don't interfere with others. And then our rules are that for internal lines, we get the Fourier transform of the Feynman propagator. And notice that I've drawn the momentum with an arrow next to the line, indicating which way the momentum is flowing. That's better practice because sometimes we'll deal with charged particles, in which case we'll use the arrow on the line to indicate flow of charge, and so the flow of charge or flow of momentum might be in opposite directions. And for external lines, we get nothing. the external lines are amputated. The line Gordon operators kill those propagators. Our third rule is for our interaction vertex. We get minus I times the coupling constant. And this one depends on the theory. Notice there's no integrals left. We've done almost all the integrals. We don't, in particular, we've done all of the x integrals. There's always we can always do those. The x dependence is just an exponential. We can always do those. There's no x integrals left. The next rule is we should impose momentum conservation by hand at each vertex. There should be no deltas here, because we've already used all the deltas. We've already used all the deltas to do some of the momentum. I'll give an example what I mean by this in a minute. Number five is having an integral d4p, 2 pi to the fourth per loop. And finally, divide by the symmetry factor.
So these are the momentum space Feynman rules, whereas before we were deriving the position space Feynman rules.
Right, and in particular for this object.
And that object is
the matrix element, which is?
Which is basically FSI.
It's basically FSI, and we pulled out a delta. We could write down momentum space Feynman rules for the Fourier transform or the correlation function. Those would be different. So they'd be closely related, but they'd be different. We won't consider those in this course, but in Q52 we will. We'll discuss those.
Can you give an example how does the third rule depend on the theory? How does it change?
Yes. So for phi cube theory, we had minus g phi cubed over 3. This was lint. Then we'd have a vertex. Three lines, the rule would be minus g.
So I can.
Would have this be a minus ig.
Yes. The vertex can change. So
the vertex, which vertex is present can change. How many vertices there are. In this course, we'll mostly consider. Theories with just one interaction term, but it's very common to consider theories with multiple interaction terms.
But still be assigned minus I times the coupling constants.
So that's right. And we ignore the factorials. Okay, let's look at an example. Look at an example. This is an example I 4 theory for 2-2 scattering. It's an order, second order term. And let's say our initial momenta are p1 and p2, and our final momenta are p3 and p4.
So time goes vertically.
Time goes vertically here. Okay, so I'm going to start with rule 4. I'm imposing momentum conservation in each vertex. So I need to have some in order to use rule one or two, I need to know what the momenta are on these lines. And I don't have enough information to do that. But that's okay, because I expect there should be one momentum per loop. So I'm just going to pick one of these, and I'll call it k. And that's anticipating that's going to be the one I'm going to integrate over. And I picked a direction here. Our final, I could have picked k going to the left. Final result won't depend on that choice. But now, once I've chosen this to be k, I want momentum to be conserved at the vertex on the left. I have p going in. If I say this momentum is going out, p1 going in. So I should have p1 going out. But I already have k and p3 going out, so I need to subtract those off. So now I have p1 going in and p1 going out. And over here, momentum, I should find momentum is automatically conserved. At this vertex on the left, I have p1 equals p1 minus k minus p3 plus k plus 3. This is from the left. And on the right, going in, I have k plus p2 plus p1 minus k minus p3. And going out, I have p4. This doesn't look like it cancels, but or it's equal, but the k's cancel out. And I have p1 plus p2, and if I move p3 over to the other side, I've got p1 plus p2 is equal to p3 plus p4, just overall momentum conservation. So this momentum is conserved here. If overall momentum is conserved, which it has to be.
Wait, sorry, what's the p there in the
left side? P, this should be 1.
Okay, thank you.
So now I've labeled the internal momenta, and I can go through and use rules. So I have propagator for the lower line, propagator for the upper line, and then I have two vertices, minus I lambda squared. And I also have one loop, one undetermined momentum. I should integrate over. And then the last thing I need to do is account for the symmetry factor. This diagram has a symmetry factor of 2. That's our result. OK, this is a good place to take a break. Let's resume in 5 minutes. And I'd like to start to discuss renormalization. And this is a big topic, and I'm not going to be able to cover everything in this course. You will learn more about renormalization in QFT1 and QFT2 and statistical physics, and also many other courses, elective courses throughout the year. I want to present some conceptual ideas and a limited set of technical results and tools, but they're definitely things we won't have time to cover in less than two lectures. And today I just want to start with some of the basic ideas or physical insights that lead us to consider renormalization. And one of the key things that goes into renormalization is the idea of separation of scales. And at least implicitly, we use this in essentially all physics you've ever learned, this idea that we can deal with physics at different energy or momentum scales independently. In your first physics course, when you were learning how a ball flew through the air, you didn't need to learn about the constituents of that ball, how it's made of electrons and protons and what those are made of, and or the expansion of the universe. You can deal with physics at the everyday scale, separately from the cosmic scale, separately from the Planck scale. So we can make predictions without knowing everything. And that's crucial for how science works, and physics in particular. And this idea is used implicitly throughout physics, but it's really one of the foundations of why renormalization works. And it's to me the most compelling reason why this is what we have to do and what we should reasonably expect for our physical theories. And so with this in mind, what our goal should be for a physical theory is to make predictions for some set of observables, which I'll call O. But that's in general not something we could do exactly at all energy scales. Really, what we actually ask of our theories is they should make predictions for some range of energy scales, which I'll call E. So we have our energy here. What we'd expect is that near some scale mu, we should be able to make predictions. And well, maybe there's some other energy scales that the Planck scale, that's some higher energy where we don't know physics, and maybe there's something interesting going on in the infrared at some energy scale 1 over L, associated with perhaps with gravity or some large distance scales or low energy scale. And this is our goal. I mean, ultimately, if we want to have a unified theory of nature, we'd want to do it everywhere, but that's really hard. And concretely, almost every theory you've studied so far has implicitly been valid just for some range of energies. When you first learned about throwing a ball and how it falls, if you throw the ball so hard, it goes into orbit, or relativistic corrections are important, but what you learned in your first physics class is going to fail. And the same is true for basically every theory. So in quantum field theory, we call theories with this property effective theories. And it's really what we're doing when we're doing quantum field theories. We're trying to make predictions in some range of energy scale. Now, often we don't know how to do this directly. And we might need to introduce some auxiliary quantities, which I call A, that might depend on lambda or 1 over L, in addition to B. And we saw this when we were looking at the Casimir effect. We knew that the force, on physical grounds, very physical grounds, that the force between two parallel plates can't depend on the details of what's going on at very short distances or very long distances. It shouldn't depend on expansion rate of the universe. It shouldn't depend on Planck scale physics. Nevertheless, we didn't know how to calculate that force directly. We had to compute the ground state energy. The ground state energy did depend on these other scales. It depended on what's going on, very short distances, going on very long distances. And this is very common, particularly in quantum field theory, that we can't compute our observables, which only depend what's going on in some limited range of energy. Directly, we said we need to introduce some other things that might have some strong dependence on what's going on up here in particular, and sometimes down here. And in tutorial today, we're going to look at an example in non-relativist quantum mechanics, how this occurs. And it's all the same physical ideas, we'll see. But technically, you'll see it's much easier. We can compute everything exactly. And so what we're going to look at in the tutorial is scattering from a local potential in one-dimensional non-relativistic quantum mechanics. So the problem I'm going to examine is scattering from a potential, which we'll assume is identically zero outside of some region minus A to A. And it's non-zero here. And this is local. I call this a potential local because it's only non-zero in some local region around zero. And so what we could study about this, one property of this system that we can study using probes at a limited range of energies, is we could determine how the transmission coefficient for a particle that's incident on this potential depends on energy, assuming that the energy is low. That's an experiment we can do at low energies. It's very analogous to what we can do in quantum field theory, where we can't probe the theory everywhere, but we can just probe it some region, typically near zero. And so be the transmission coefficient you'd expect that asymptotically, x very large, the wave function should look like coefficient a to the ai p dot x, our incoming wave function, be some reflected wave function. Be the minus IP dot x, and over here is the transmitted. A function e to the I dot x. And what we want to determine is T e is T over A. Transmission coefficient. So what we expect based on physical grounds is that at low energies, we're not probing all the details of this potential, just probing some sort of average of this potential. If I added some high frequency component and modulated this wave function on a very short scale, it shouldn't affect the transmission coefficient at low energies very much. And in fact, what we expect is that the details of this potential shouldn't matter so much. We should get the same transmission coefficient if we have some exact model for what's going on at all energy scales, which would be this potential V of x for all x. That includes information about what's going on at very short distances. We do expect that we should be able to approximate V of x in the limit that EA is small. This is a dimensionless coefficient, that dimensionless quantity that you can use to characterize what we mean by low energy. So this should be something like constant delta. If we take A to zero, this is something like a delta, and we can systematically improve this approximation. Something very closely analogous to a multiple expansion. And you'll show in tutorial that the next term in this expansion is like a derivative of a delta. And this can be systematically improved. And what you expect is that you should be able to predict this low energy transmission coefficient from these coefficients, C1 and C0, some order, and go to higher order, C2. We also could calculate these C, if we had an idea for what the model of V of X is at all energy scales, we can compute these. But only the first few terms in this expansion are what we could actually measure experiment. So this is, in a sense, a low energy effective theory, an effective theory. And many different models might give this the same coefficients. There are aspects of this potential that won't be captured in the first few terms that have to do with the high energy, when it's a very short distance properties of this.
What does delta prime look like? Is it two spikes or?
Yes. Okay, so delta prime is a distribution. One way to think about it is distributions behave nicely under integrals. So I have an integral of some function of x, delta prime of x, dx. I can integrate by parts and get minus f prime of x, delta of x, which is minus f prime of 0. And in a sense, we can construct a delta prime as a limiting procedure, like we could do for delta. And so what we expect delta prime is it something that's like infinitely big and then infinitely small. In a very small region. So delta prime, this is a loose way of thinking about it, but also a useful way, be something at the very big positive spike and then a very big negative spike. Okay. So this is what we'd expect to do. And in a sense, this has to work. There's no way a low energy experiment can possibly measure the detailed shape of V of X just using a low energy probe. You need a high energy probe to determine V of X on short distance scales.
Sorry, yeah.
Yes.
So you're expanding out the potential V of X in terms of deltas and higher order deltas, delta functions.
Mm-hmm.
Is there an equivalent to sort of Taylor's theorem that says you can do that for some nicely behaved function V of X? Like, in principle, if I include all the infinite terms,
mm-hmm.
will I precisely capture what the function V of X is doing?
I'm not aware of a theorem like that. So, and my suspicion is this is actually an asymptotic series. So I don't suspect this converges. But this is a very, very close analog of what we're doing in quantum field theory. And quantum field theory generally doesn't. I'm not certain about that, though. It could be. Maybe it does. Okay, so the problem, though, is that if we want to compute the scattering amplitude, or the transmission coefficient, in this case, we can do it. There's no problems for this first term. For the second term, what we find is that it diverges if you try to compute it directly in this. What we need to do that is regulate this expression, just like we did for the Casimir effect, where we used a cutoff in the UV and the IR to make our intermediate quantity, which in that case was the ground state energy. In this case, it's the wave function.
Wait, sorry, how come it? Why does it diverge? What makes it diverge if you include the delta prime?
So physically, the calculation you're trying to do is trying to, with some given potential, determine the relationship between these coefficients. What we know is that if we looked at this potential exactly, the wave function would be relatively constant for large x and small x away from the origin, but in the middle, it's going to, in general, change rapidly. So in order to match what's going on over here and over here, the simplest way to do it is by finding the wave function in the middle, which involves high frequency modes. By making references to low energy modes only, at least I don't know how I would compute this. So the fact that we our results shouldn't depend on the high frequency components.
Oh.
But
is C1 like definitely a high frequency? Like, wouldn't like each successive correction be higher and higher frequency? And so maybe C1 isn't super high, and so it wouldn't make it low?
Yeah, it's not clear which coefficient. From the level I'm presenting here, which coefficient this problem will arise. I'll show in tutorial that it happens at this order. So in order to do a next to leading order, compute the next to leading order correction, this, you need to deal with the high energy modes. But you know the answer can't depend on the high energy modes. You just have to use them in the middle to do your calculation. So that fact is actually very powerful. You know many features of the result, and that gives you some powerful constraints on the dependence of our observable on our effective theory.
When we replace the potential by delta function, so originally, if we were just working with the potential, we would need to impose conditions on the boundaries of the potential, saying that wave function has to be continuous, the derivative has to be. But if we work with deltas, then it doesn't make sense to do that because there is an infinite potential at the boundary, and the two components of the wave function will be effectively disconnected in some sense.
Yes, that you're illustrating the problem. So if you zoom out, potential has to look like this: A goes to zero, P goes or P goes to zero. Potential has to look like this. It means that there's singular behavior in the wave function. Physically, we know that there's something. The wave function is not going to be singular. The potential is not going to be singular. But so there should be some smooth potential that describes the scattering. Problem is, you can't measure that exactly. So experimentally, you expect to be able to measure something like this. Theoretically, you expect there's something like this, but you don't know what the details are. The claim is that those details don't matter, and we can still make useful predictions, but starting from this. And just a word about the UFT analogs of what we're doing over here. So in principle, there might be some theory, some UV complete theory, some theory of the microscopic physics. In quantum field theory, usually we don't know that. We don't have an analog of this V of X. In fact, it's very hard to write down something that's consistent in the same way that this is consistent, high energies. What we're dealing with in quantum field theory is an effective theory like this. And what our effective theories look like, we can do some very simple or crude dimensional analysis to determine what we think our effective theories should look like. So let's suppose, let's just restrict ourselves to Lagrangians that are the Klein-Gordon Lagrangian plus some terms that are powers in phi. Minus. And I'll just write down a few to see that. Okay. So do some dimensional analysis here. We know that dimensions of the Lagrangian are four. We're in four space-time dimensions. Because the action is dimensionless, and Lagrangian action is the integral of the Lagrangian. And that tells us that the dimension of field is one, because e phi squared has dimension four. Derivatives have dimension one each. So two plus twice the dimension of phi is four. And that allows us to immediately read off the coefficients, the dimensions of the coefficients g, lambda, and h. So what's the dimension of g?
One.
One. And lambda? Zero. And h?
Minus one.
Minus one, yes. And so let's see what we'd expect, how we expect the dependence on these coefficients to, how we expect the importance of these various terms to vary as we vary the momentum. So let's suppose that in the full theory, in the interacting theory, we have some observable that depends on some momentum scale, which is called p. Forget about the vector. The fact that these are momentum is a vector, say it's at some energy scale. Using perturbation theory, what we do is we'd write this as free operator at p, and we write down a series. For if we only have the g term, by dimensional analysis, we expect we have a g over p, the first correction. The first. And we can have a g squared over p squared term. So at low energies, this term is important. For lambda, well, it's already dimensionless. And so this is, at least at this level of analysis, equally important at all energy scales. And for h, h has dimension minus one. So we do the same thing, same dimensional analysis we expect. Hp plus h squared p squared. So this is unimportant at low energies. So we expect for writing down a theory at low energies only interaction terms where the dimension of the coupling constant is positive or zero are important at low energies. That's our expectation. So a coupling constant which has positive mass dimension is called relevant for this reason. That low energy experiments, these are important, at least typically. And coupling constants with zero mass dimension are called marginal. This level of analysis says they're equally important at all energy scales. If you do a more sophisticated analysis, you can find that actually it might be more important at high or low energies, but that depends on the details of the system. And we'll learn how to do that later in the year. In the other case, where G is negative, the dimension of G is negative, are called irrelevant. And we expect these to be unimportant at low energies. So this analysis suggests that if we want to try to write down a theory that describes all the physics we want to do at low energies, we don't need to, there's only certain types of terms that we should write down, namely those with relevant or marginal couplings. And that's what we do. So for historical reasons, these are called renormalizable theories. And this is I'm slightly oversimplifying here. And then irrelevant is non-renormalizable. These are historical terms and are not accurate, and you can renormalize in a particular sense, even theories with irrelevant couplings, non-renormalizable theories. So if our goal is to look at the low energy physics, which is all we can expect, we should look at relevant and marginal couplings. And that's what we're going to do in this course and in future.
Even when we are considering the lower energy scale, mm-hmm. doesn't mean that the momentum in the loop should be treated for the lower energy scale.
Absolutely, that's right. And that's related to the fact that generally we don't know how to compute these directly without making reference to something else that involves physics at other energy scale. And so what we're going to find is that while we expect a theory like this with no irrelevant terms describes low energy physics, we should be able to find some way to make predictions for what goes on at low energy, and we can do that. But we won't be able to do that without talking about going on at high energies. So the loop integrals will involve high energies, are just like our calculation of the force, Casimir force, involved the ground state energy, and that involved physics at high energies. The loop integrals are an analog of the ground state energy, both physics at all energy scales. And so that's so these are the theories we're going to consider for that reason, because that's our goal, is to describe the low energy physics. I'll leave it there. Thank you.